Welcome to the Literary Escape Podcast, the only podcast that serves both readers and authors of historical Christian romance. We read, discuss, review, and rate books in this unique romance subgenre, and sprinkle in a few contemporary Christian suspense books. Authors, we bring you inside tips and tricks from those who have gone before you. Then we bring both readers and authors together for fun-filled live Q&As. Literary Escape is the one-stop shop for both readers and authors to connect, learn, and grow together. Let's dive into this adventurous episode. Welcome back, everyone, to another exciting Friday book club discussion. Today, I'm so excited to have Lynn Blackburn back with us on the podcast. This time, she's going to talk to us about her Defend and Protect series. So welcome, Lynn.
Thank you for having me. I'm happy to be here.
Yeah, it's always a joy to chat with you about your books. So I remember we did a little emailing back and forth, and you were concerned about one of our book club members, Tiffany, because she's just not into the suspense. It kind of, you know, and you were a little concerned that she might need some chocolate as as she reads these books. Now, she made it through without chocolate, but when we talked about it, we had a big bag of chocolate there with
her. I love it. Good. I love that.
She said, I just went through them really fast, and I kind of skipped some of the scenes where there were some dead bodies. She said, I want to say it's in your second book in your Gossamer Falls series, where there's kind of like a landslide, and there's a lot of dead bodies that...
Oh, yes. Yes, there are. Yeah.
She said, that's really what got her in the last series we read of yours. She goes, this was so mild compared to that.
I didn't even think about that one. Because I guess in my head, I think it's more traumatic. I guess it's because for me, which is, there's no way to say this without it sounding wrong. The dead bodies aren't the problem. For me, it's when someone is being either when they are in the story, when they are afraid, when they're being hurt, when they have been hurt in the story. Those are the ones that I feel like I have to be a little extra careful about getting the point across, but not getting too deep in it.
Yes.
If they're already dead, and that sounds so terrible. There's no way to talk about romantic suspense without some of that. But if they're already dead and it's bones and bodies, I guess my brain just sort of glosses over that. Do you know what I mean? Like I don't, which is part of what I can read much scarier things than I can watch. I don't do horror at all. I don't even like really suspenseful movies because if I'm watching it, my brain can't protect itself from the gore or whatever. If I'm reading it, I feel like I can just kind of, you know, I can not let my mind go all the way there. So I'm not actually picturing every little thing. And that makes it easier for me to do. But yeah, that is, I can see where she's coming from with that. I just haven't thought about it. That's awesome.
I would say I'm in the same boat. I cannot watch it. It's just too graphic for me. Like I can't even do like the crime shows. Now I do love the British crime shows because they're not gory.
They're so much more. I don't watch a lot of them, but I have seen a few. And I just think in general, they are a gentler or more gentle. They're just a little softer about that kind of stuff. I used to watch a lot more crime shows. And I actually had a friend one day who's like, the reason you're freaked out all the time is because you're watching this stuff. And I thought, you know, she might be onto something there. And sure enough, I can't do it. I loved NCIS. I always watched NCIS. That was my favorite. I actually had to explain a give slap to somebody the other day, which was fun. I was like, so, but I think the thing with NCIS, it never felt like that could actually happen to me. It felt just enough out there. And so it didn't bother me. But some of the ones that are more, you know, they feel like, no, that could actually happen. And I don't need to think about that. I just can't do it. So yeah, I have to be really careful about that.
Yeah. Well, we loved your Defend and Protect series. I love all the way you wove in details about the Secret Service and how it works, you know, how they move through their phases.
Right.
I absolutely love that. So how much time did you spend researching that as you built those characters?
It is tricky. The Secret Service is kind of tricky to research because they don't really have much out there. There's not a lot that you can get a hold of. I had a secret weapon, though. I know someone who was in the Secret Service, and they actually served on President Trump's first protective detail. So they had gone through phase one and phase two. And then when they were ready to leave the protective detail, they actually moved into a different part of government because, again, as you can kind of see from the books, it's very time consuming. It's not a family friendly job. And I don't mean that critically. It's just, especially the protective detail, is all consuming. You're on the go all the time. You're constantly traveling. And then it's also a lot of, you're sitting in a hotel room just waiting. And then then you're on for however many hours they are out in the public eye and that kind of thing. So before I even pitched the series, I checked in with him to see if he would be willing to talk to me. Obviously, nothing classified or anything like that, but would he be willing to talk to me? And he was very gracious. And so we spent several hours on the phone just with him explaining the phases and the other things the Secret Service does. Actually, it was that conversation that kind of set the format for the series, because I had the idea of a known threat where the agents themselves were under attack. And then I knew I wanted to have, obviously, the presidential protection aspect of it, but I wasn't sure what to do with the rest of it. It was really that conversation where I was like, oh, they do so much more in financial crimes and identity crimes and things like that. So and they actually have a podcast. They have a podcast called Standing Post. I haven't listened to it lately, but I listened to it quite a bit while I was writing them. And they have agents come on and talk about different cases that they've worked. And when it came to malicious intent, there was a case that was a combination of the FBI and the Secret Service, and it was a ransomware case. It was a malware case where they had been going after people for the ransomware that comes up in malicious intent. And it turned out to be this huge, huge thing. And I had already had the general idea of that book, but not that aspect of it. And I was like, oh, perfect. That will work great. And so then I obviously went into a deep dive on ransomware. And then, interestingly enough, when I got to the third book, I wrote myself in a hole because I take the approach that if it's not that I have my head in the sand and I think everybody who works in law enforcement or the FBI or anything like that is a white knight necessarily. But also, if I'm writing about this, I am not interested in tearing down the Secret Service or painting them in a negative light. And I want them to be, and just in general, as a writer, my characters, part of what makes people like our characters is their competency. They need to be good at what they do. And so I had written myself into a situation where I needed my agents to have a problem because I needed that scene, but I also needed my agents to be really good at what they do. And generally speaking, the Secret Service doesn't come up in the news unless there's been a problem. And it's generally when something has gone wrong and somehow something has not. I mean, we've seen a lot of that in the last year or so.
Yeah.
Where somebody didn't, you know, someone got too close, or because the idea is that they should never get that close. We should never hear about them. Ideally, we should see them, you know, with their sunglasses and driving the beast or whatever. But if in their world, the idea is that you never have an issue. Well, I needed an issue. And so it's like, how am I going to do this where there is a danger, but they're still doing their job and they are competent and good at what they do? And so I sent him an email and I was like, I don't have any idea what to do here. How do I fix this? And he called me back and we talked for another couple of hours, and there's nothing more for me. Nothing more embarrassing than trying to explain a story that is in process to the expert in this field. You know, this is their real job. I'm fictionalizing all of it Mm-hmm. Plus making sure there's lots of romance and you know, all of that. And then being like, so, because you feel like you're a toddler explaining something. And oh, it was awful. But he gave me some suggestions. And without any, it does, I don't think this spoils anything. That's where the drones came from in Under Fire. Because I've never done this before or since, but I had actually gotten to a point in the story and I knew that something would happen. And then I knew what happened after that something happened, but I could not figure out what would happen. And so I actually jumped ahead and then kept writing from there while I kept brainstorming it. And when I finally gave up on my pride and decided I needed help and asked for help, he was able to provide some help. And I do remember thinking, look, if my editors don't like it, I'm going to be like, look, take it up with him. But it was really interesting that then there was a lot of research on drones. And I mean, we call them drones, you know, unmanned, aerial, whatever.
Yes. That's the first time actually reading your book. That's the first time I've heard somebody call it that.
Unmanned aerial vehicles. Is that a UAV? Yeah. Was that? I can't even remember now. Yeah. You can do some research on that and get some very opinionated takes on that. So yeah, it kind of varied. I really like to do, when it comes to research, I have a love-hate relationship with it. My personality wants to know everything so that there's nothing that could possibly be wrong. And then there's the reality of writing fiction. And I'm trying to remember, I think it's Brad Thor. Brad Thor writes political thrillers. He's got like a gazillion of them. And I heard him talking one time and he referred to it as, I think he calls it realistic fiction, where it's the idea is you want to do enough research so that it is in the realm of possibility. But then you also are writing a story and it has to be a good story. And real life is not always a good story. And so there's a line there between, yes, I am taking some liberties. I have to take some liberties to make this a romance. You know, I mean, that's just the way that's going to work. But I want to do enough research that it is clear that I didn't just pull this out of thin air. Yeah. And where anybody familiar with it would be like, there is nothing right about that. Which is also one thing not, you know, since I don't write historicals, because historical readers, you know, you better know that that word was not in use in 1827. And it, mm-hmm. because it didn't come into use until 1912 or whatever. So I don't have that issue, but I also struggle. Sometimes I read a book and there was one, I don't remember who wrote it, but I'm reading along. I'm like, yes, yes, yes. We know you researched flying a plane. Like it was just
too much.
Every knob and switch and flip. And I was like, I call that the Tom Clancy syndrome. I loved Tom Clancy when I was younger. But, you know, he actually got called on the carpet from the CIA because they thought he had had a source that was telling him stuff he wasn't supposed to know because it was so detailed. And I jokingly say, you know, after you read The Hunt for Red October, you kind of think maybe you could actually drive a nuclear submarine because you get so much.
Wow.
And so I'm like, I don't want to do that either. I don't need to do that. I got to find that balance. So I probably did do more research on that series than on anything ever because of the phases and just the timing and trying to get everything just right. And I'm sure there's still mistakes, but at least then you go back to, I just wanted it to be a good story. And so there's that.
No, I thought it was great. And I think the third book, so it was that Under Fire. That was my favorite. And I think when we all talked about it, that was our favorite out of the whole series. Cause you actually have two novellas between book two and three, which are great. We loved those too. We loved them all, but I think everyone said that Under Fire was their favorite. And I don't know if it's just because you're wrapping the series up, you know, how that goes. And there's always been this tension between Zane and Tessa, and you're trying to figure out what was the issue. And the issue put in there, I never saw that issue coming. Like, that was not on my mind.
That's not what you were thinking. Interesting.
Yeah. So that people can read it. But
that's not what I thought it was. Well, it's funny because I think my third books tend to be most people's favorite. And I do think it's because of the buildup for those third book characters, because you get glimpses of them everywhere up to that point. And then you're so ready for their resolution that really with the Dive Team series, people are very opinionated about Gabe, with Gabe and Anissa, and that Gabe was everybody's favorite until the Defend and Protect series. And then Gil was a favorite until we got to Zane. And then it was like, oh, well, maybe we kind of like Zane, and everybody likes Zane and Tessa. And I think people were already talking about Mo in the Gossamer Fall series as soon as I wrote the first book. And I was like, yeah, you got to wait for book three for Mo. And apparently that's just how I do it. I do this to myself. And then it puts a lot of pressure on that third book to get it right. I typically write three book series, maybe a few novellas in there. And I think the first book is the hardest to write because nobody, including me, knows these characters. And because I'm setting things in play that once they're in print, I have to deal with them in book two and book three. I can't change it. So if I set it in book one and that book made it all the way to print, then I either have to deal with it or find a way in the story to change it. Mm-hmm. And so book one is the hardest and followed very closely by book three, because book three is hard for completely different reasons, because I know the characters. I know their backstory. I know what's going on with them, but I've made all these promises. And because readers are very invested in the third book.
Yes. I will say we are desperate to read Mo's story, but we'll wait. We got to wait till next March to finish that one. I will say, even though Under Fire was our favorite book, Gil is still my favorite character. I just love
a few friends who are frequently Team Gil. Like, they'll be like, we do love Gil. Gil's great. I loved Gil. He was a good one.
Was he your favorite to write, or did you have another favorite?
He probably was. I really liked Gil. And I even liked the fact that because there's a novella with his twin, and I didn't see that coming at all. I don't remember when I decided he had a twin. I think it was kind of a spur of the moment thing in book one, when things happen and she comes on the scene temporarily. And then she showed up big in book two. And I went, well, hello, Emily. And I loved their relationship. And I always love a good sibling relationship anyway. I loved their relationship. And then getting to know him better. And of course, I mean, who doesn't love a man who cooks, right?
I mean, come on.
So I still have a couple. I had wooden spoons made. Like, because you can get them made like for weddings and things like that. And it says Gil and Ivy, and it has the publication date, and it has a quote on the handle. I've never been able to bring myself to use one. I mean, I could make more anytime. I could have them made anytime, but I gave them to my my launch team for that book. That was like part of their thing. Cause it was like, he's a cook, he's a chef. He does all these fun things. So yeah, I do wind up with a lot of food in my books. There's Lee and the Dive Team and Gil and the Defend and Protect, and then Cassie and Gossamer Falls, because clearly that's one of my love languages.
Yes. Yes. Well, we loved it. I remember I was like halfway through the book and I looked at my husband and I said, I am in love with Gil. And he's like, excuse me? No, let me explain. I said, I'm in love with him because he reminds me so much of my husband. I'm like, and that comment that she made about, like, I can see how a woman can be hooked, addicted to this because you just spoil me. And I was like, that's you. And he's like, of course, the typical man, like, oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, sure. Now you say that.
Yeah, but it was just funny, his reaction when I said, I'm in love with Gil. He's like, excuse me? Don't worry, he's not real. Goodness. There was the other thing we really loved is that relationship between Luke and Hope. So Hope is Faith's sister. And we loved the immediate, like, I felt like they just immediately hit it off.
Yes.
And kind of teamed up against Faith.
Yes, I loved them. And that was... I was really glad Hope got a novella, because there's actually, so at the end of Unknown Threat, when everything is really coming to a head. I'm trying to say this without any sort of spoilers, but everything's coming to a head. And Faith is concerned about the safety of her family members. And I originally wrote a scene. It wasn't, maybe not even a full scene, but there were, it was at least a couple of pages at the end in that area that involved Charles taking responsibility for Hope. He was the agent assigned to protect her, which is how they met originally. But it slowed the scene down too much because it wasn't really about them. You know, I mean, it wasn't about the plot, and it was kind of a little sidebar. Mm-hmm. And I really liked it, but it was just too, I think I cut it even before I sent it to my editor because it just didn't belong right there. I mean, that's where it happened in the timeline of the events, but it just slowed the story down too much. And so I have that in my back pocket thinking maybe Hope will, you know, fall for Charles. And so then when I had the opportunity to write the novella, I was like, oh yeah, these two are definitely it. And part of it is, I think it's an interesting dynamic. My sister, I met my husband when I was 19. My sister was a senior in high school when my husband and I started dating. And they had a very antagonistic relationship for years. It was a combination sibling and also you took my sister kind of thing, you know. And they are quite close now and very much like it, you know. I think my sister is like, that's just, you know, my brother. I've got this brother I never had. And it is, they have always, in a fun way, but just back and forth and teasing. And some of that definitely came into play with Hope and Luke. But that whole closet scene mm-hmm. in Unknown Threat is based on real events, sort of. I obviously am not in a wheelchair and did not get squashed. But I was sitting in my living room and heard this crazy sound. I couldn't figure out where it came from. I'm looking all over the house. I'm like, what was that? Hours later, I go in my closet. And the whole shelf has fallen down. Every box is, you know, it's two layers, and the top shelf has come down. All the boxes on the top are in the middle of the floor. It had pulled out of the wall. My dad is like, yeah, because you put too much stuff on it, which may or may not have been true. And so at the time, I was like, it could have hurt. If anybody had been in there, it would have hurt. And stuff was everywhere. And then it was a pain to clean up. And so I was like, I can use this. I think I was writing Unknown Threat at the time. And I was like, well, I guess Hope's about to get squashed. And it worked out perfectly. I was like, oh, this will be fun. And my closet is now much more secure because my dad came through and made sure all of the, the brackets were in actual studs as opposed to just those little annoying things where it just can pull right out of the sheetrock. Yeah. And so, that was based on real events. Sort of.
Well, I thought it was hilarious, and the way he wanted to call the ambulance in, but then she was mad at her sister, and he's like, "Wait, that was me." But then in her novella, I liked too that he automatically was like, "Can I help you?" rather than just assuming she needed his help.
Yes,
you know, like getting back in the wheelchair and things like that. He was very respectful of that. And then in the novella, I love how he just kind of takes on that protective brother role.
Big brother. Yep. Yes. Yep. I'm the brother here. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I actually did talk to a couple of people who are in wheelchairs to mm-hmm. kind of get a feel for some of the difficulties of maneuvering and then, you know, just how they like to be approached, because there is, you know, I have a daughter with disabilities, but cognitive disabilities. And so in the disability world, I think sometimes people see someone in a wheelchair and they assume that there are cognitive disabilities as well as physical disabilities. And while that certainly is true in some cases, that is not always the case. And so sometimes people are just very, I don't know that they are meaning to be, but they are very rude and disrespectful toward people because they act like they have no agency and they have no, you know, can't speak for themselves or anything, which is very frustrating to people who are like, there is nothing problematic up here. I am more than aware of what's happening. I just physically cannot do XYZ. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, then there's also some really great, I'm always aware of it because Emma can still walk, but we're never sure how long. I mean, she's very mobile, but it's not uncommon for people with her syndrome to lose mobility as they get older. And so I'm very aware of things like beaches where they have these, basically like a sidewalk that is intended to be where people can get to the sand on these special sidewalks. They're not sidewalks, but they're almost like a really thick rubber mat sort of that mm-hmm. rolls out all the way to the surf so that because you can't get a wheelchair through the sand.
Yeah.
And so it's so frustrating. So if you can get to the hard packed sand, then most people could move around on that part of the beach, yeah. but not through the dunes and through the sand part. And so they have these things that go from the boardwalk to the hard packed sand, so that people can actually get to the beach. And so I did all sorts of random research on that one too. And I was like, oh, look. And I now know where certain North Carolina beaches that have these sidewalks that are available. Cause I think it's great. And I don't claim by any stretch to be knowledgeable in all forms of disability advocacy or anything else. I'm just more aware of it, I think, because that is my life. And yeah. certainly prior to Emma, I didn't really know anything about it. And so I try to make sure there's some representation there and also to be very sensitive to that and to some of the challenges that one of the people I talked to had been, they were trying to get, I think in Raleigh, they were trying to get through somewhere in Raleigh and could not, there was no way to get in that building. It was not going to happen short of somebody picking them up and carrying them and then taking the wheelchair, you know, it was. And so there are still, you know, and depending on where, you know, a place is older, mm-hmm. they weren't built that way, understandably, no criticism, but it does make it harder to maneuver. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. So, and even Hope's story was also semi-based on a real situation. We know someone who was hit by a car. They were fine, but it scared everybody half to death. And the person just literally waved them across and then pulled out. And it was, thankfully they hadn't gotten enough speed and they were able to, they fell, but they weren't run over or anything like that. But that was, I was like, you know, so that's kind of how it works in most of my writing is sometimes something happens that I'm aware of. And then it just sort of, it swirls around in there and comes out differently, but yeah. there's a kernel of inspiration there that came from something that happened to somebody.
Yeah. I think that's probably true for a lot of authors.
Yes.
As well. My great grandmother, actually, she was hit and drugged by a car when she was like 8 or 9. And she was on crutches from then on out. Oh. Like back then, I mean, she was born in 1919.
Okay.
So,
yeah.
You know, back then they just didn't have a lot, but she used to have to still go to, she used to tell us they've had like, is it a Model T car or something like that?
Yeah.
And she would have to ride, her dad would drive her down like once a week or something. She had to go to Riley's down in Indianapolis because she was like a case. They studied her had happened to her foot and her leg that had gotten caught in the front of the car. And yeah. So, you know, it is interesting too how those life events end up in our story.
Yeah, they show up.
At some point I'm probably going to use that just because I write historical, so you know, she goes, I just remember, you know, I was like, oh, I get to ride in the Model T, and you know,
so it's good for her.
Yeah. Oh, and she was a very independent woman. She lived on her own till she was she 98?
Holy cow.
Yeah. And she was sharp. Wow. Like her mind was sharp the whole time. I say funny, she's a tough little woman. She was, she had actually slipped and fell at home at like 2 a.m. because she was a night owl. She liked to stay up late. And then she just laid on the floor the rest of the day. But my grandparents went daily in the morning to, you know,
check on her.
Everything. And my grandma, it was her mom. She goes, Mom, why didn't you call me right away? We would have come. I can't believe you laid here on the floor. She didn't break a bone. They were afraid she broke her hip.
Sure. Yeah.
You know, she didn't break a bone. And then she got all upset because they're like, you have to go to the nursing home for so many months for therapy, you know, to, you know, all this stuff. And she's like, I don't want, She did not want it. But I'm telling you, by the time she got in there and she met all her roommates, then she goes, you know what? I just really love sitting and talking with all these old people.
Yeah.
That's what she goes, all these old people. I said, I was like, Mama, you are the oldest person in this building.
Love it. Oh, I love that. That's great.
Yeah.
That's hilarious. All these old people.
She cracked us up. Yeah. All these old people, you know, so. Anyways, it's interesting. I love hearing those little story, behind the scenes stories to say, hey, this is based off something that really happened. Or I will say with this series, I think our biggest fascination was with the Secret Service and learning all of that stuff that you're like, man, you just don't realize what all they do.
Yes. I mean, you do. You think you see them, you know, in the sunglasses, standing outside, you know, running beside the car. And that's really a very small percentage of what they do as a whole. And depending on where you're posted, you know, if you're posted in an office out west or, you know, maybe in, I don't know, anywhere other than the Northeast, you are far less likely to have protective work at any time. You're mostly going to be working cases. The exception to that is the New Jersey and New York offices, because New York has all of the UN officials. So not only do they have, there's something in September. What is it? There's some kind of a summit. I don't know if it's a financial summit. There's something UN in September that basically no one in like the whole Northeast practically is allowed to take any vacation time during that stretch because they're all needed to provide the protective details for all of these dignitaries who are coming in and then to provide protection at the locations. And when that happens, all of your investigative work just goes on pause because the protective detail trumps everything else. And then you just come back to it when it's over. Whereas for most people like my North Carolina, you know, agents, they're typically doing investigative work, financial crimes, counterfeiting, things like that. And they only stop that when there's a president, vice president, candidate coming into town. And so, but even then, when they come into town, everything else goes on hold. We do that. And then when they leave, we go back to our normal work. Mm-hmm. But yeah, apparently the New Jersey, New York, and then of course the DC area, those are the locations, the postings where they could even in their phase one, could still wind up doing an awful lot of protection, even though it wouldn't be presidential protection. It would be protective details for all the other people who are in town. New York, because of the UN, and then, of course, DC for all the heads of state that come through. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it's really, it is really, and there's also, they do a ton of stuff on mass shootings, which I did not know, but they do. I think Tessa does something related to that in the third book because they go in and help. They have all these studies and then they go in to the local offices, will talk to the school districts to help them set up their procedures for school shootings and things like that. So it's a very broad mandate, I think. You know, you've got the financial crimes and the anything that involves mass shootings, and then also, of course, the protection aspect. So
yeah,
it definitely was more than I had no clue until I started researching it.
Yeah. We do have to ask, because this was a question that came up. So more than one of us in the group do not care for snakes whatsoever. So, you know, in the third book, there's the snakes, which we totally agreed with Tessa, like burn the mm-hmm. car and no mm-hmm. I don't want anything out of it, I'm done.
Yes.
So
yes.
What's your opinion on snakes?
Oh, I hate them. I despise it. I can acknowledge, I'm a good Southern girl, I acknowledge that black snakes have a purpose. They keep rodents out of your yard. They're good to have in your garden. They are still, I don't want to see them. I don't want to come anywhere near them. I have to really work to leave them alone. A black snake, I just can't. I get it, but I don't like it. The rest of them, of course, I'm just not a fan. Not a fan. I also, though, feel that way about certain bugs. I don't love, not generally too much of a scaredy cat about bugs, but in the South, we get these things called palmetto bugs. And they're about this big, like a couple inches. They're basically flying cockroaches, except they're huge. And this is the time of year. There's nothing you can do. This isn't like a cleanliness issue. They're attracted to light. And so they'll, like at night when the porch light's on, things like that. But again, they fly. So if you don't, and they crunch when you kill them, you know, because they're, and so if you don't get them, they'll fly off. I cannot stand them with any, I hate them so much. They're awful. Yeah. And anybody who's ever been around one, I think would agree with me. They're horrible. And I will 100% pull the husband and son card on that one. I'm like, y'all go take care of that, because when they fly off, you just can't. I just can't. So yeah,
I can't handle the crunchy either.
It's the crunch. Yes. I don't want to kill them because they crunch, but if you don't get them on the first try, they fly off. They're awful. So yeah, I do have a few. I'm not as phobic about the snakes as Tessa is, but they are definitely. And I did debate that scene. I did. I needed something, but I debated whether that was going to make readers just be like, nope, I'm not reading another page.
No, I thought it was great. It's so relatable for me, because I'm one of those that's more like Tessa when it comes to a snake. Like, I have literally been, one was in the yard, and I've literally been like paralyzed by fear so much I couldn't move.
Like,
I was just stuck. So I totally got it. And so when they asked her, hey, do you want your go bag out of your car? And she's like, no, burn it. I'm like, yes, right there with her.
Right there. Just be done. Yes.
I can definitely, like, I'll kill a spider. I'll kill them all day long. I got it, you know, because, you know, some people really don't care for the spider part of things, but you put a snake in front of me and I'm just done.
It's done. You're done.
I mean, at one time, another one just really surprised me and I started hyperventilating. My fingertips were turning white and my husband's like, get in the house and lay down. He's like, I'll take care of it.
I don't know
what it is about them. They're just creepy.
No, I agree with you completely.
So yeah, so when we read that, we're like, we got to ask Lynn, like, what does she think about the names here?
Love it.
So, well, we love this series. I think we've done all your series now on the podcast.
I think so. I think you have.
We started with your dive team investigations, and then I think we went out of order, because I think then we went to Gossamer Falls, and then swooped back for Defend and Protect.
Yes.
But are we missing any in there?
No, the only other books I have are my Love Inspired Suspense books. There are two. I actually still love those stories, but they're now 10 years old. Covert Justice came out in 2015. And I actually have a third book. This makes a couple of my readers very frustrated with me. And I respect it. I acknowledge it. I actually have about 25,000 words written on a third book. And what happened was I sold the Dive Team series to Revell, and I've just never had time to come back to that. And with Love Inspired Suspense, when you first sell to them, eventually you can get to a point where you are writing a series and they'll tag it as such. But they all still have to stand completely alone. They have to be able to be their own story. So I still have this in the back of my head thought that someday I'll actually write that third book and finish it off. But I've also thought about just trying to get, I may try to get my rights back to it. I don't know. They actually took the two and published them in German, which was super fun. And they're set in North Carolina, in Etowah, North Carolina. And Covert Justice was my very, very first published book. And it was great, but you still can't, the paperback is out of print. And so you can read it on a Kindle. Or you can find it used. Like, you can look at, like, I actually bought some used off of Amazon because I could not get them. And I'm like, well, I need to have a few of them.
Yeah.
And I found one time in a used bookstore. I was like, yes. Because, I mean, they're, you know, it's about 57,000 words. So it's longer than a novella, but shorter than most of the others. But yeah. I don't know. Maybe someday. I have my hands pretty full right now. So there are already plans for more books. And so I've got to do these revisions on the last book in Gossamer Falls and then move on. And so that's what's on my current agenda.
That's awesome. I know, because we're all eager to read that in March for sure, to wrap that series up. What's the best way then for readers to keep up with your writing?
The very best way is to sign up for my newsletter. I'm not spammy about it. I typically send 2 a month. I send one out early in the month that has some sort of a freebie, not from me, but from somebody else, another romantic suspense author. And then also kind of highlights what's new, like who has a new release, that sort of thing. And then I try to send out a newsletter later in the month. Right now I'm working on one that's going to be, have a backlist giveaway of some sort. And then the plan is in August, I have a deleted scene from Break by Fall that I'm going to share in the newsletter. So that's the best way. I have started very slowly trying to blog a little bit more often. And you can also subscribe to the blog. And then of course I'm on social media, Facebook and Instagram, and at Lynn H. Blackburn. And, you know, I post there. I'm not super busy as far as going different places, but I am going to be at Reader Rendezvous in November up in, where am I going? St. Louis. St. Louis, yes.
By Just Read.
Just Read, yep. Yeah. So I'm going to be there. I'm very excited about that. And then I'm going to be teaching at a small conference in January at the beach. And so that's my...
Is that Lynette Eason?
Mm-hmm. The Seaside Scribes?
Yes.
I'm not on the website yet, but I am going to be there for a couple of days. The tricky part is I told her, I said, Lynette, I really want to do it, but I have a book due February 1st, and that's in January. And so I'm coming down, I'm teaching the early bird and then one other class. And so I'll be there for like 2 nights. And then I'm probably going to just get a hotel on the beach somewhere and write. Because I have this dream that someday I won't be on a deadline panic, but it has yet to happen. So anticipate that I will actually be frantically writing in January. So yeah, but I'm always, and then, you know, like I have an email address that's on my contact page. I got an email a couple weeks ago from 2 young ladies who had been listening to your podcast, and they are 12 and 14. They're in West Virginia, and Grace and Krista. So if they hear this, hey, Grace and Krista, they're so fun. They have been reading my books, and they're working on a romantic suspense that they're writing. And I've loved it. I don't always respond immediately because, you know, I'm busy, but, you know, people can always shoot me an email and I'll do my best to respond because it's, you know, it's fun. And I love that these girls are reading and writing. I think that's such a great way to, I was reading at that age, but I certainly wasn't writing, and I would have never emailed an author. I would have been completely intimidated. I wouldn't have done it. And I was so glad that they did. It was so sweet. It was awesome.
I love to hear that.
And then they're like, we heard you talking about something. Maybe it was this podcast. I think it was this podcast. And they were talking about it. And I was just like, well, awesome. I love that.
That is so awesome. So lots of ways then to connect.
All the ways.
Definitely. I, as an author, I could say I love getting those emails too. Just that personal connection, it's just so great. So
I'm telling you, sometimes you get an email and somebody just says, I just want you to know how much I enjoyed your book. And it never fails. It's on the day when you're just like, I am the worst author ever. What am I doing? I'm a fraud. And that's when you get that email, and it's 2 lines, and it's so comforting and encouraging. So yeah, I'm always up for that. Yes. Thank you, readers, for doing
that.
Thank
you. Yeah. Well, thank you, Lynn, so much for hanging out with me and chatting about your books. I loved it.
It was great. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for tuning in. I hope you enjoyed this episode. If so, please consider signing up for our free newsletter. Each week, you'll receive news about our events for both readers and authors, plus updates on my books. You can sign up at literaryscape.com/newsletter. Until next time, happy and blessed reading and writing.